We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Let's talk about what happened locally this week in the news.
Yeah.
Some good news this morning to start off the show. We're going to talk about the recall Sawant vote. The final count has been certified, and Shama Sawant has won the recall election by 310 votes.
Wow.
So congratulations to her.
For winning that. 50.34% to 49.62. And, you know, the reason those percentages are important is because an automatic recall happens within 0.5%. And she just beat that out. She had 0.72% for her margin of victory. The recall campaign can still request a recount. They have to do it by the end of the day, Tuesday, and they would have to pay for it themselves. And then if by some divine intervention they happen to win after the recall, which is vanishingly small chance would take place, but then the county would reimburse the campaign for its money. Given that the attempt to recall Sawant has already poured $1 million into the effort, I'm fairly confident that they have the cash on hand to pursue a recount if they want to, and they probably want to.
Well,
it's not going to go anywhere.
I checked the Seattle Ethics and Elections to see how much cash they have on hand, and it looks like they've got somewhere around $47,000. So it is possible that, and it looks like they might have the money to pay for a recount. So it's kind of up to them. We'll see what happens by the end of day Tuesday.
But congratulations to Shama. And to note to the Seattle Times, your coverage on election night should not be quite so giddy. Never bet against Shama in an election.
You would think they would have learned by now.
This is the fourth time she's won or had to, you know, face the voters, and she's come out on top every time. And I think only once in 2015 was she comfortably ahead on election night. Every other time she's come from behind. And, you know, she has got the most formidable political operation in the city right now because they've had so much experience. They've had experience, you know, getting out the vote at the last minute, and they've had experience chasing ballots for those ballots that were contested. And that's another reason why, I think the chances of a recount coming in out in the opposite result are very, very, very slim.
Mm-hmm.
Reminds me of a line from The Wire: when you come at the king, you best not miss.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's probably the only good news we got for the rest of the show, in case you'd like to turn things
off. There's some little nuggets. nuggets coming up.
It ain't happening in the pandemic news, I'll tell you that.
Well, incoming Mayor Bruce Harrell is starting to announce positions.
That phrase is just creepy.
Yes, I know. Mayor-elect Bruce Harrell this week announced some of his top staff. As Erica Barnett noted on her blog Publicola this week, 10 of the 11 people he announced have been recent insiders at City Hall, with half of them having worked with Mayor Jenny Durkan. And that includes his new deputy mayor of housing and homelessness, Tiffany Washington, who is currently serving as deputy mayor for Jenny Durkan. And it also includes his budget director, Julie Dingley, who currently works as interim innovation and performance director for Mayor Durkan. And before that, served as Durkan's lead budget staffer. And that in particular is bad news because, you know, over at least the last 2 to 3 years, Mayor Durkan has been in a constant push and pull with the city council over her budgets.
And her budgets never balanced.
Yeah. And
that's the part that gets to me.
Yeah,
they would always force the council to actually like do the work of making a budget that would work.
Yeah, yeah, and that was particularly true in 2020 with the first COVID budget, where the city council rolled up their sleeves in 2019 to take a look at it, or the 2021 budget, they rolled up their sleeves in 2020 to take a look at it, and it turned out that it didn't make any sense. So the city council central staff had to sit down, do up their own spreadsheets, and figure out why the mayor's budget didn't balance, and then find the shortfalls and tell the city council, well, look, she's using this trick and that trick, and it isn't penciling out, so you're going to have to find more money to balance the budget. Really, the job of the mayor to find the money to balance the budget, not the city council after the fact. So the fact that there's going to be a continuation of the same staff working on the budget into the Harrell administration doesn't bode well. Also, Durkin has been, she's been taken an axe to the budget to cut programs that the city council has routinely funded and has expressed in the past that they want those programs to continue. Durkin has cut some of those programs in her draft budgets, and then used the money she saved from that to spend on her own priorities, and
or just not spent the money in the following year, even after it's allocated.
Yeah,
she's done that too.
Yeah, but that also, just the fact that she would first, when she drew up the draft budget, she would first cut a bunch of programs that the city council has funded for years and direct the money elsewhere, meant that the city council had to spend a lot of time going back and restoring that funding. And they've done that year after year after year with Durkin. It's not clear to me that
particularly diversion programs.
Yeah. And
public safety.
Well, yeah, but other programs as well. Even things that should be the mayor's priority, like food programs, for example. And so it's disconcerting to see that there's not going to be any change in the mayor's budgeting staff, from the current administration to the new one. And then, because, you know, I'm not exactly sure that this all came at the behest of Durkin, that she might have given the directions, hey, I want to spend on these items, but it's really the budget staff then, I think, who draw up a blueprint for her to then kind of finesse a little bit. So my feeling is that it's the budget staff themselves who are the ones who kind of decide, okay, well, these are not on the priority list. Doesn't matter if the council has funded them for years and wants to continue to fund them. We'll cut here, 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 and here, and then we'll fund these programs that the mayor has prioritized.
And a lot of those programs that have been prioritized by the mayor around homelessness, for example, have been spectacularly ineffective.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to see some continuation of that, too, given the new city attorney and the new HSD.
Yeah. So also a couple of other staff who are continuing over from the Durkin administration into the Harrell administration. Bruce Harrell's chief equity officer will be ADM Emery, who currently works as a division director at the Seattle Department of Transportation. That new position, chief equity officer, is the job that Bruce Harrell came up with during a candidates forum, and said that he would commit to having a cabinet level person to oversee racial justice and racial equity initiatives. And that's what this new position is. Also carrying over from the Durkin administration is Harrell's head of external affairs, Pedro Gomez, who currently serves as the director of small business development in Durkin's Office of Economic Development. So that shows you what external affairs is going to mean under Bruce Harrell. It's going to be business development and business relationships more than say, for example, climate change initiatives or something like that.
It's going to mean you know, having a hotline phone in his office to take calls from Amazon.
Right, right. In addition, Harrell is appointing friends, family, and colleagues to his administration, including Moesha Harrell, his niece, and the person who served as his campaign director. I think most folks expected she would get a plum position in the Harrell administration. And because she's not a son or daughter or his partner, his immediate partner, or, you know, one of his parents, then she doesn't fall under the city law that prevents a mayor from appointing a direct relative as a staff person to work under them in the city. She's a niece, so she's distantly enough related that she doesn't fall under that legal prohibition. She will become his chief deputy mayor. So she's going to be literally his number two person at the city. He also...
At least her name isn't Ivanka. That's all I got to say.
Yeah. And so he's also appointing former council member and political ally Tim Burgess, who was also a former cop, to fill another brand new position he's created at the city called Head of Strategic Initiatives, which means Burgess will be overseeing whatever projects Harrell decides are major priorities for his administration. Typically, that's what the deputy mayor does, I think. So I'm kind of looking at this going, okay, why create a whole new position for this? And my thinking on this is that Burgess is possibly going to be the new propaganda minister, or possibly he's going to be the guy who goes around to places like Amazon and Microsoft and begs for money. And because that's something that Bruce Harrell said he would be doing is hitting up large local businesses to donate to his various priorities to make them a reality in the city,
yeah,
rather than raising taxes on
exactly.
businesses and wealthy people.
Yeah, that's where I was going with that. That was his answer to why don't you want to tax wealthy companies in Seattle, since it's where all the money is.
Yeah.
And he says, well, you know, they'll give it to us.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, philanthropy is a really bad governmental model because it enables corporations to determine priorities.
Yes.
For public money.
And you can't budget if you're relying on donations, because donations are not consistent year to year. So it makes it really impossible for you to set up new programs based largely on contributions when they're not a consistent money income stream.
And that kind of philanthropy also invariably
at
that
right,
level.
It comes with strings attached.
Exactly. It comes with strings attached. So you're allowing companies to dictate public policy.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. So it really is, you know, Amazon calling the shots.
Yeah.
You know, Shama Sawant's worst nightmare has come to pass.
Yeah.
So he becomes the liaison between the Chamber of Commerce and the City Hall, to a degree.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, essentially. Well, you know, Bruce Harrell is pretty clearly going to be the lead representative for the Chamber of Commerce in city government at this point. Because none of the other council members, and I'm including Deborah Juarez and Alex Peterson in this, are as responsive to the needs of the Downtown Business Association and the Chamber of Commerce as Bruce Harrell is.
And one thing that I would not say about either Juarez or Peterson, they are not the kind of empty vessels that Bruce Harrell is.
Yeah.
So I mean, I don't think he's ever had an idea of his own. And we saw that in the campaign where he really didn't. He just spewed word salad for 8 months.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that's entirely fair. I mean, he came up with the whole idea of having pizza night for the Seattle Police Department if they didn't kill anybody that week, didn't he?
right. To have watch a video, eat some pizza, watch a video, and then sign a pledge that they wouldn't shoot people. you know, and violate their rights. That was his idea of adequate racial equity training in the Seattle Police Department, or adequate training.
So it's not really fair to accuse him of not having ideas.
It's just not having.
It's just they're not workable ideas.
Good ideas.
No, they're not good ideas.
True. And also, Harold also announced that he would be appointing Vin Tong, his former council aide, to work on technology and equity issues. So things like expanding broadband to all households in Seattle and things like that. So a lot of very, very familiar faces and business as usual at the mayor's office, particularly when it comes to designing the budgets, and that just don't make a whole lot of sense. So that's something that really stuck, bothered me about his list of appointments.
Yeah, that's just the one so far.
Yeah. Now, this week, City Attorney-elect Ann Davison announced a couple of appointments as well. The most disturbing one that was very disturbing to me, and one that was actually really good news. But first, the disturbing one, right? Her deputy city attorney will be none other than Scott Lindsay, who ran his own.
Oh, my God.
Yes, he ran his own failed campaign for city attorney in 2017 when Pete Holmes trounced him that year. Lindsay's recent report about homelessness in Seattle led to Como TV's Seattle is Dying special report, which then fueled a right-wing jihad to criminalize poor people living in Seattle, including the homeless. His most recent political experience was serving as public safety advisor to former Mayor Ed Murray. In that job, Scott Lindsay implemented the navigation team. He came up with and implemented the navigation team to sweep homeless encampments, and he made policing of the downtown core, especially Third Avenue, his top priority. Before he joined Murray's administration in 2014, Lindsay had worked in Washington, D.C. as an investigator for the Democratic House representatives who sat on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. But Lindsay has no courtroom experience, like Ann Davison, who has almost no courtroom experience. And this is a very bad sign for an agency like a city attorney's office that has to deal with courtroom cases all of the time. Lindsay has also been a leading critic of Pete Holmes's work as city attorney. As deputy city attorney, Lindsay is going to be working as hard as he can to do things like unwind diversion programs, file charges against as many suspects as possible, regardless of the seriousness of the crime. And he'll end the practice of utilizing outside counsel to help the city win lawsuits that are filed against the city. Holmes has had a really, really good record of winning those types of lawsuits because he recognizes the need for the city to get good private counsel who are experienced in and knowledgeable of the case law about the types of cases that are brought, types of lawsuits that are brought against the city. Lindsay has purposely said that he doesn't like the fact that Holmes hires outside private counsel to assist in those types of lawsuits. So Lindsay will probably hamstring the city attorney's office in
that.
So
you can expect taxpayers to pay for a lot, you know, settlements and a lot more lawsuits. Yeah.
Yep. Now, on the other hand.
Oh, before you jump to the next one.
Oh, yeah.
I also wanted to point out that he's also the son-in-law of Christine Gregoire, whose endorsement, along with Gary Locke's, really threw a lot of votes for Davison.
For Davison, yeah.
That's true.
That's kind of a nice little bonus coming out of it.
Now, before you put your hands over your eyes and start to cry.
Too late.
Davison's second appointment, the good news, Davis's second appointment is Natalie Walton Anderson to the criminal division. She'll be the criminal division chief at the city attorney's office. And that is a much, much better appointment. Walton Anderson has served as the liaison to the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program and was instrumental in making that program get off the ground and fly. Walton Anderson is not only familiar with LEAD, but familiar with the whole concept of diversion programs and what makes them work well and what doesn't, which really paints, and, you know, this made, folks working, in the diversion programs and working to get, the diversion programs to expand. It really made those folks take a nice deep breath and go, okay, business as usual. For now.
And I would say also it means that somebody in her her leadership team actually knows how the court system works.
Yeah. And that paints a really interesting picture of Ann Davison, doesn't it? This woman who is a pro-Trump Republican, at least in her public persona, or social media persona. But she puts out this tough on crime vibe in her rhetoric when she was campaigning. But, and then she appoints Scott Lindsay, right, who has the same kind of rhetoric behind him. But then when it comes right down to it, it's continuity. She just went for a person who would ensure continuity, with the previous city attorney's work. So that's interesting. I just kind of wonder if she wants it both ways. She wants to kind of soothe the business community and say, hey, you know, we're going to crack down on crime, while at the same time, she also wants to soothe the fears of folks who have been struggling to change the way the criminal justice system works in the city of Seattle to make it more fair. I just don't know. I just don't know how long she'll be able to reconcile those two urges. But I thought that was kind of interesting to see that the top folks at the city attorney's office, it's a change to the sort of let's crack down on people regardless of the severity of the crime. But then when it comes to the nuts and bolts, it's business as usual and continuity with the Pete Holmes city attorney's office. So there was another job change at City Hall. The current director of the city budget office, Ben Noble, has said about a week and a half ago that he would leave the budget office, but he didn't announce right away where he was going. This week he announced that he will become the first director of the new Office of Economic and Revenue Forecasts. The city council created that new office in 2020 because they were concerned with the revenue forecasts that the city budget office was providing them, with the mayor's approval. They were worried that the city budget office and the mayor were withholding information from them or not providing them with a full range of estimates and the full reasoning behind their revenue estimates. For political reasons. So they decided, let's create a new independent office that will look only at revenue forecasts and how the local economy is doing. Now, that new Office of Economic and Revenue Forecasts will have a four-person oversight group made up of two city council members, the mayor, and the city finance director who works under the mayor. So while Ben Noble's move to the new office may initially look like the mayor is trying to take over this new office, I think it's important to remember that Noble was actually the director of the city council's central staff before he went to work in the city budget office under Mayor Durkan. So I think this move is really a sign that he didn't feel at home under Durkan, and he didn't like being in the firing line, especially from people that he had formerly worked for and worked with on the city council. And I think that he wants to work more closely with the council on revenue forecasts and looking at the economic situation in the city as a whole. I think it might also, having this new Office of Economic and Revenue Forecasts may also shift the rhetoric a little bit about how well the city of Seattle is doing economically, because I think for political reasons, the mayor has a tendency to try to make her budgets and the revenue forecasts sync up with the complaints she's hearing from businesses around the city and from the Downtown Business Association, for example, complaining about homelessness and complaining about, you know, people hanging out on the street, on Third Avenue downtown. And so, you know, and complaints from people like Scott Lindsay who say, oh, Seattle is dying because look at all the homeless people. When in fact the city's economy is actually going full blast. And our economy is not lagging, even under COVID-19. So I think this new office may make it, it's really a move to try to get a good sense of what is really going on economically in the city that's outside of the whole political realm. Let's get some numbers that reflect reality, not reflect, you know, what your main constituents feel.
So, and by your constituents, we mean your political base. We don't mean actually the city as a whole.
Well, by your constituents, I mean, I'm talking directly to the mayor.
Right, sure.
His or her constituents being the Downtown Business Association or, you know.
Yes, like I said, their political base.
Yeah. What Jeff Bezos might be feeling about the city of Seattle isn't necessarily what's actually occurring economically.
We can ask Jeff how the city looks from space.
Yes, from his 1 million mile view or whatever.
Anything else on appointments for this week?
Nope. There'll be more, I'm sure.
Oh, there's got to be more. In fact, as Brian Packer, who writes at The Urbanist, noted yesterday, that city departments that still need leaders. Currently, the list is at the police,
very long.
Library, housing, economic development, arts and culture, sustainability and environment, planning and community development, city budget office, human services, human resources, and as of yesterday, now transportation.
Yes, so, and Durkin has been limping along for the vast majority of her term in office with interim directors because she just didn't want the city council to vote on whoever she wanted to run her departments.
Yeah, that was the Trump gambit. And she took that model.
Yeah, she adopted that model. And it'll be interesting to see if Bruce Harrell continues that as well, or if he actually appoints people and then lets the council vote on them, which, you know, it legally is what's supposed to happen.
And if he appoints people who are not blood relatives.
Yeah. So what? The city council got another update this week, this time on the electric scooter share program. In the transportation committee meeting, the Seattle Department of Transportation gave an update on the electric scooter and bike share pilot program, which ran from October 2020 through September 2021. There are close to 5,000 of those small electric scooters scattered throughout the city. You've probably seen them with about 900 electric bikes.
I've nearly gotten run over by a few.
Oh, yes, me too. And I tripped over a few too. The data from the pilot program shows that people have used them mostly in the summer when the weather is good, but usage drops off once the cold rain sets in. No surprise. We had that data, same data from the electric bike share program before. Now, the average scooter trip is 1.4 miles in 15 minutes, which means people are only traveling at about 5.6 miles an hour. And I was really surprised by that because you can walk that distance in about 25 to 30 minutes at a moderate pace. Okay. Each trip costs an average of $6.63. That's a per hour cost of $26.52. Kind of expensive, which is probably why each user in the program averaged a total of about 3 trips for the entire year. So there are not many regular users, unless, of course, you're looking at the folks who get a discount. As part of implementing the program, SDOT had promised that they would provide discounted rates to people who are low income. And there are about 300 or so of those folks in the system using at the low income rate. Those folks actually have taken many, many more than three trips per year. So it seems that price is a hurdle for most people for using a scooter. And I would also say efficiency, because if you can get there, you know, if you can save the money and just spend an extra 10 minutes, people are likely to just walk that, right? So a few things that SDOT promised with this program haven't come to pass. For example, SDOT said that there would be no riding on sidewalks. They promised that. So. And I have to say, almost every time I've actually seen someone using a scooter, they've been on the sidewalk. I have
unless there's a bike lane, yeah, it's always on the sidewalks.
I've never
and weaving in and out among the pedestrians.
Yeah, I've never seen them riding in the bike lanes. I've seen them right on the sidewalks, right next to the bike lane.
Yeah, I've seen that too.
And I've rarely, rarely seen them riding on the street. And when I have, it's been a very dangerous looking. They've been doing some very dangerous things in the street. So that promise did not come to pass. SDOT also promised that as helmets would be required and that there would be vendors to provide them to scooter and bike share users. However, I have yet to see a scooter rider actually wearing a helmet.
I don't think I have either.
Yeah. According to the scooter and bike companies, about 70% of the riders who rented their equipment didn't wear helmets over the past year. That's bad.
I think it's more like 100, but that's just me.
Yeah, I think it's closer to that as well. Now, scooters and SDOT also promised that scooters and bikes would not be parked on the sidewalk. Again, that's the only place I've seen them parked.
Pretty much, yep.
Yeah, and many times seen them blocking the sidewalk. Now, while SDOT says that they've been issuing $20 fines for each bike and scooter that they find improperly parked, the four vendors in the program have been directly passing that fine on to the last rider of that bike or that scooter. So it's not really a punishment for the vendors to try to make sure that their riders are actually correctly parking.
They have no incentive to clean that up, in other words.
Yeah, so the vendors are not really doing a good job of educating the riders and getting them to park them properly.
But that is a disincentive for those people who tried it out and then, you know, don't want to do it anymore because it cost them $6 plus the 20 fine.
Plus the $20 fine for not parking it properly, exactly. Now, finally, SDOT promised to do a safety study with Harborview and the UW on the scooter bike share program, but that study never actually happened because of COVID-19. Instead, SDOT has contracted with a private company to do a survey of riders regarding their safety while riding the bikes and scooters that are provided through the program. The results of that study are not available yet, just preliminary results, and SDOT's going to be issuing a report in January at the soonest with those numbers. As for the preliminary safety data, SDOT said that 17 police reports were filed involving scooter collisions with cars. Anytime there's a car accident that causes at least $1,000 in damage, there has to be a police report filed. Okay, there's no such requirement for scooters. 17 police reports were filed involving scooter and collisions with cars. One scooter rider suffered no injury. 10 had minor injuries. 5 had serious injuries, and there was one fatality. SDOT says that its survey of 4,141 riders show that 2.6% had been injured to the extent that they needed medical attention. So of those 4,000 riders, that means about 107 of the riders they surveyed needed medical attention. And if you extrapolate that percentage to the total writers for all four vendors in the program, that would be 12,621 injured people in a year riding the scooters, right? And even if you assume a lot of overlap in ridership between the four vendors, say a lot of those riders signed up with all four vendors, that's still more than 6,833 people who were injured last year riding a scooter. That's terrible. That's a terrible injury rate, considering that they're only traveling at a little bit faster than a walking pace. So that may be why many of these riders only rode the darn things three times, right? First they rode it to check it out. It wasn't that efficient. Maybe the second time they rode it, it was an emergency and they needed to. They ended up parking it wrong and they got a $20 fine. They didn't ride it for a really, really long time. And then finally, again, they needed it in an emergency and they rode it and got injured, right? It's just not worth, I think in that case, you really have to ask yourself, is it worth continuing the program, right?
The customer experience does not sound real good.
No. And SDOT also promised that there would be equity in how the scooters were deployed around the city. They promised the city council that a certain percentage would be deployed to the outlying neighborhoods, particularly the south end and the far north end, where people of lower income live in the city. But their heat map of where scooters are located and were used show that the vast majority of them are still only being used in downtown Belltown, South Lake Union, Capitol Hill, and the First Hill areas, just the core of the city. And very, very few were in South Seattle or north of the Ship Canal.
And just, you know, anecdotally, the people that I've seen using them are, shall we say, not ethnically representative of the city either.
Yeah, or demographic, or in terms of age, they've all been very young.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, if you're 65, you're not going to be going around on a scooter.
Yeah, and if you're disabled, you're not going to be standing on a scooter, riding a scooter to get someplace.
No.
Typically. SDOT has promised to continue the electric scooter and bike share program into 2022 and is promising that it will work harder to educate riders and get them to wear helmets, park the scooters properly, and try to avoid injury or riding them on the sidewalk. But the city council should, I think, put the brakes on the scooter program, the scooter portion of the program, immediately to avoid potential lawsuits from people who are seriously injured or killed in accidents with them. There's already been one fatality, and I don't think being killed riding a scooter is something that anyone should have to experience. And we know that those lawsuits are coming at this point because the preliminary safety data is already there, and it doesn't take a whole lot of work to figure out that this preliminary safety data is very bad.
And we don't have a city attorney who knows how to defend against those lawsuits.
Right. So, and they really need to end the electric scooter portion of the program now.
Let's move on. Delays in the new long-term care payroll tax.
Yeah. The Washington State Legislature in 2020 passed a bill to set up a new program called WACARES. That would be a program to pay for long-term care coverage for Washington residents who pay into the program through a 0.58%, so a little more than half of a percentage payroll tax. So, for example, a person making $50,000 per year in Washington State would pay about $290 per year in payroll taxes to the state to fund this program. Residents who've paid into the fund and need financial help for things like in-home nursing care, assisted living, or who need to pay for a nursing home can get up to $36,500 of benefits from the program. It's a great program for people who don't qualify for or can't afford to buy their own long-term care insurance. And if you look at the requirements to qualify for long-term care insurance from a private insurance company, there are a lot of conditions that will automatically eliminate you, that they will come back and tell you, sorry, we can't offer you a policy. And I have to say that I'm one of those people. who there's a couple of things that I have that automatically disqualify me from ever being able to get private long-term care insurance. Yeah. So it's a great plan for people like me and for lower income folks in Washington state. But the law included an option for people with their own private long-term care insurance to opt out of the payroll tax with a year, and it gave them a year for them to apply for the exemption. But many private insurance companies stopped issuing new policies for long-term care in August of this year because they were inundated with requests from people and they couldn't process them all. Nevertheless, a flood of people filed applications to opt out of the tax, a total of 450,000 people, almost half a million people in Washington. Yeah. In addition, many people complained that they could be paying into the fund for 30, 40, or even 50 years before they would ever claim benefits. And of course, the more money you make, the more you pay into the plan. But the maximum benefit you could ever receive from it is $36,500.
Which is about two nights stay at a hospital.
Yeah. Now, if you make less than $150,000 a year, the WA CARES plan looks like a pretty good deal. But if you make more than that, it starts to look like a bad deal. So guess who's been complaining in that regard, right? It's people in the high income bracket. Now, the law also contains a provision that says you have to pay into the WA CARES fund for at least 10 years without a break of more than 5 years in the middle of those 10 years, or you have to have worked at least 3 of the last 6 years at the time you apply for the benefit. So there are some people who are very close to retirement age and are expecting to be very healthy when they retire, and who would be paying into the plan for maybe 2 or 3 years, but would never actually be able to draw any benefits from them. And there are also some folks who only work intermittently in the state of Washington, not continuously, or who expect to retire and move to another state and won't be able to get benefits from the plan that they paid into if they're living, say, in California or Arizona or something like that.
In other words, it has flaws.
There are some flaws, yeah. In addition, it's not clear whether members of the military could benefit from the program or people who are not yet U.S. citizens but who pay into the plan because they're residents working in the state of Washington. They're on a green card or something. So with all those complaints, Governor Inslee this week announced that the payroll tax will not begin on January 1st as originally planned. Instead, he's going to delay the tax until May 1st after this year's Washington state legislative session to give state legislature time to revise the law and fix some of those flaws. The Democrats in the state legislature have said that they will vote during the legislative session for an additional 1 year delay until April 2023 to give people more time to get private long-term care insurance if they want, but also to give people some time to look at the changes being made and decide whether or not the public plan is fine for them. So that was, I think, pretty good news this week.
Yeah, well, I have even better news. This is like our one, other than Sawan, our one ray of really good news this week, which is that people have been hearing all week about potential strike by Kroger and by Fred Meyer and QFC workers. They're UFCW employees, and they went on strike yesterday. And Kroger had been recruiting scabs to replace them. This morning, UFCW and Kroger announced a tentative agreement. So the strike is off now, until at least, workers have a chance to vote on the agreement. But UFCW was pretty positive that they got what they wanted. So we will see how the vote turns out, but, no strike at QFC and Fred Meyer. So that's good news.
All right. Well, let's just jump back into the bad news.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about what developed with the pandemic this week.
Yeah. Well, we had a media advisory from Seattle King County Public Health yesterday, as well as the virology scientists at UW, who've been doing modeling. They estimated at the beginning of the week that 13% of new cases in Washington State were of the Omicron variant. By the end of the week yesterday, they're now estimating it's 40%. And they are saying that new cases in Washington are about to explode, and that they will be three times in King County, they're talking about, three times the worst peak at the peak of Delta, which the peak of Delta was like 840 a day. So they're talking maybe 2,000, 2,500 a day by the end of this week, by Christmas Day. That is not good news, especially going into holiday weekend, next weekend. We will be on the air, though. We don't ever take holidays. So the state public health department of health has really been behind the curve on this. So far, they've only verified 10 cases of Omicron in the state. Five of those have been in King County, but that is a long way away from King County's health public health agency saying that it's now 40% of cases in our county. This is extremely contagious, and we'll talk in a minute about some new studies that have come out this week. Of course, scientists around the world have been scrambling to try and understand how Omicron works and how it compares to Delta, and most of the news on that front is not good either. Did you have anything else local, Maria?
No, I don't local.
Okay. A lot. A lot has been happening nationally and internationally as well. Nationally, a week ago, Omicron had been verified in 22 states. That count is now up to 39, and I expect by next weekend it'll be 50, all 50 states. We had an important court ruling that came down, I believe, yesterday. The 6th District Federal Court in Cincinnati reinstating the Biden administration's employer vaccine mandate for companies with more than 100 employees.
For private businesses.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And for that, we've been seeing all this week companies scramble to try and figure out what to do in the absence of that mandate, because conservative judges have been blocking it. And of course, the plaintiffs, which are a bunch of Republican-led states.
Yeah, that case is now
going to the Supreme Court, probably.
Yeah, that case is now headed to the Supreme Court. And we'll see how they decide. A lot of employers are not doing the vaccine mandate just yet because, you know, they think the Supreme Court will overturn it. We'll see.
Yeah, we saw yesterday Boeing dropped its vaccine requirement for employees. Meanwhile, we've seen a couple of other companies. Delta is offering bonuses to employees. Who was it? Oh, it's Google that is adding money to companies' health insurance costs if they are not $200 a month, I believe, if they are not vaccinated, which strikes me as a innovative, but only works for companies that actually offer health insurance, which mm-hmm. is not a majority of the workforce right now. So that's been moving quite a bit. We saw a report from an investigative committee in the House of Representatives yesterday that told us what we already knew, but it added fresh details to it, which is that the Trump administration, for political purposes, downplayed the threat of COVID-19 at the beginning of the pandemic, and thereby, people may remember, or, you know, for traumatic reasons, you may have blocked it out of your memory, Donald Trump's daily supposed COVID-19 updates, which ended once he recommended that people ingest bleach as a way to rid themselves of the virus. And I will always remember the video from that presentation where you can see standing off by the wall Deborah Birx, who was supposedly the lead medical authority in that the White House coronavirus task force, just looks like she had swallowed a rat. her testimony to the committee was really kind of eye-opening in terms of talking about how basically the political operation at the White House shut out the people who had experience in virology or epidemiology or any kind of public health expertise. It was strictly a political operation designed to make Donald Trump look good by downplaying the virus and misleading the public as to either the threat of the virus or the effectiveness of the federal government's response. Both of which were wildly inaccurate. So the question that is raised by this is, okay, you've got these people testifying under oath that this happened. Is there any criminal culpability? Because right now, because public health was politicized by the previous administration, we have 800,000 dead people in this country. That is a nearly genocidal level of negligence. So, who's responsible? I mean, clearly you can't prevent all of those deaths because there's very few countries that have been able to consistently mount a political response to this virus, a competent response, I should say. But at the same time, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths because the right wing in this country followed Donald Trump's lead and embraced conspiracy theories and absolute nonsense over public health expertise. And because you've had a major political party in this country, which controls half the states, which has, basically become a pro-death party, as we saw with the lawsuit, protesting the vaccine mandate. It's been anti-vaccine, anti-mask. And that alone has cost countless lives, and the amplification through right-wing media of dangerous nonsense has cost countless lives. And you can go all the way from hydroxychloroquine to ivermectin, and I forget what it is, but there's a new one now that's particularly ridiculous. And, every shade of snake oil salesman and grifter has been taking full advantage. And this in the middle of a pandemic. It's really been discouraging for those of us who followed the pandemic closely to witness this. But the question now is, okay, we've got this information. It's on the public record. It was, testimony under oath. What do we do with it? Is the Department of Justice going to get involved? Are any state prosecutors going to get involved? Because they should. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah. There were a couple studies this week on the Omicron variant. One was a UK study, which you'll talk about, Jav. The other one was a study by the largest private health insurer in South Africa, showing that the Omicron variant is more resistant to the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine than other COVID-19 variants. But the Omicron variant in South Africa at least caused less severe illness than the original variant and the Delta variant, which is still the dominant form here in the U.S. Hospital admissions among people who fell ill with the Omicron variant in South Africa were 29% lower than the original version of COVID-19. The one exception is for children under 18 who have a 20% higher risk of hospital admission with the Omicron variant. Now, the Pfizer vaccine provides a 33% protection against getting infected with the Omicron variant, but it provides 70% protection against being hospitalized with a serious illness from COVID-19. So that's very good news. And that protection level seemed to be consistent across all age groups. It's not clear yet if there's a difference between people who have been previously infected with COVID-19 who then got vaccinated versus people who were vaccinated but hadn't had COVID-19 before, or people who were only who had not been vaccinated and had the illness before. So your body produces slightly different antibodies and maybe a different number of antibodies to the vaccines versus having had a previous infection. Okay. The incubation period of Omicron tends to be shorter, just 3 to 4 days. The infection itself tends to be fairly mild, at least in people in South Africa, with recovery after about 3 days. So you recover very quickly. The main symptoms with Omicron were a scratchy throat, followed by nasal congestion, a dry cough, headache, and muscle aches, particularly lower back pain. There tended to be fewer cases of respiratory infections with Omicron and fewer people who needed a ventilator. Now, of course, South Africa is not the United States or the UK. In South Africa, only about 36% of adults are vaccinated. It's closer to about 60% here in the U.S., in some areas much higher, like here in King County. And in some areas...
I would also add that the South African population is much younger than either Western Europe or North America.
Yes, and here's another difference. In some parts of South Africa, up to 80% of the population has had COVID-19 already. They were infected by the original variant. Very early on in the pandemic. So in some places it's 70%, in many places it's up to 80% of the population. And if they weren't infected in the first wave of COVID-19, they got the Delta variant. Also, South Africa is not issuing booster shots yet, which is definitely happening here in the U.S. And there's some hints that maybe having the original Pfizer vaccine plus a booster could provide more than 33% protection against getting infected with Omicron. So those are some mixed news there, but I think leaning in the good news category with the South Africa.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the Imperial College study in the UK.
Because that
contradicted the mm-hmm. South Africa study in several important respects. Yeah. They were looking at basically the first half of December cases in the UK. And so it's a fairly large sample size, and demographically the UK is much more similar to the US than South Africa is. So with that caveat, Omicron they found is 5.5 times more likely to reinfect people who already had some version of COVID-19. They found that the two main vaccines that the U.S. uses, Pfizer and Moderna, don't offer much protection against Omicron. And they also found that it is not necessarily milder than Delta was.
Well, the way they worded it was the jury's still out on that.
Yeah.
That preliminary data didn't give them much information on that. So that's what I think is important for people to know about the UK study.
One other thing that has been coming out this week that I think is important, even though we haven't gotten any guidance on it yet from the CDC, or for that matter, the state or county health departments, which is that people's viral load tends to be much higher with Omicron. That's one reason why it's more contagious as you're breathing it out, you know.
It seems to affect the upper respiratory tract more, and that would indicate that you carry a high viral load in your nasal passages in your upper respiratory tract. So that would mean it would be easier to spread when you cough.
Yeah. And I know mm-hmm. we're running out of time. So,
yeah. Okay.
So where I was going with that is that, the prior CDC guidance that, for outdoor, activities, you really have to be around somebody in close proximity for 15 minutes in order to get it. That is a much shorter time frame right now. It's not clear whether you can get it by casually walking around and passing someone or not. But the contagiousness of infections, the fact that anybody who's infected is on average is infecting two or three other people. That would indicate that if you're walking around outdoors, regardless of your vaccination status, wear a mask and, you know, keep washing your hands, keep social distancing and wear a mask because this is extremely contagious. And as I said, in King County, they're talking about having three times the number of cases that they had at the peak of Delta.
All right.
And happy holidays.